So the son of Sam and the Phantom of the Bronx, both names in the 70s that were making headlines in the newspaper, were the same person.
Welcome to the Cops and Writers Podcast. On this show, you will learn how to write the best crime-related novel or screenplay possible. Your host, Sergeant Patrick O'Donnell, worked the streets in one of the nation's largest police departments for over 25 years. Ride along with O'Donnell and his expert guests as they help you navigate the oftentimes confusing and misunderstood world of law enforcement. O'Donnell and his guests on this show do not represent any law enforcement agency. The content of this show is not meant to be legal advice. You think you need a lawyer? You probably do.
Hey, Cops and Writers, thanks for being here with us today for another episode of the Cops and Writers Podcast. I'm Patrick O'Donnell, and I will be your host for today's show. This show is listener-supported, so thank you to all of you who keep the show going. I would especially like to thank those of you who are patrons of the show, most notably Francis Sheldrick, Kathleen Donnelly, Fran Cross, Catherine Kovacic, Richard Tolles, Ryan Ta, Melinda Colt, and Carl Vondero. Your generosity helps pay for the software, equipment, and my time producing this show. Yes, you too can become a patron for less than a cup of coffee or a pint of Guinness. Just go over to patreon.com/copsandwriters. I would also like to thank all of you who have purchased my books in the Cops and Writers series, available on Amazon. Welcome back, everyone, to the conclusion of my interview with best-selling author and psychologist, Dr. Michael Capriali. Dr. Capriali holds a PhD in behavioral science with an emphasis upon addiction psychology. Dr. Capriali spent 100 hours over 34 sessions with one of the most feared murderers in America's history, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. the Son of Sam. Dr. Capriali wrote an amazing book titled Monster Mirror, 100 Hours with David Berkowitz, once known as the Son of Sam, that chronicles his time with David Berkowitz. Dr. Capriali shares valuable insights into his time with one of our nation's most notorious serial killers in history that are relevant to the times we are living in today. As a special treat to everyone, I brought in my friend and colleague, podcaster, author, and retired NYPD detective Vic Ferrari. Vic spent most of his life in New York and shares his perspective of the case from the point of view of an NYPD detective and resident of New York. Please enjoy this thought-provoking and sometimes disturbing episode with Dr. Capriali and Vic Ferrari.
Yeah, by the time I arrived at that first session, we had already corresponded a few times in letters. So in the correspondence, we both kind of agreed that wouldn't it be great to put his story in print.
Okay.
And he had been waiting for that. He had had other people write the book, write books about him. But either the books took this, very dark turn, and it was all about sort of feeding that appetite in our culture for bloodshed, or it took the more like Christian cheesy, turn where it was sort of like Velveeta cheese, like, now I love Jesus, but there really wasn't any understanding of the psyche. The fact that I had both qualifications put me in this position where he said, you'd be the right guy to tell the story, to really speak to the mental health crisis in our nation and why we're seeing 13 mass shootings a week in the United States. David can relate to a lot of those people that have committed those mass shootings. In fact, the guy that killed four on the campus 2 years ago, the college campus killer, was it Utah? Brian Kohlberger wrote David Berkowitz a letter, wrote him two letters. So he gets letters from these types of people all the time. Some of them are reaching out for help. And he, I'll tell you, I've got some of the letters behind me. He's done his best to try to help those that are in that dark place that he was in the 70s.
Yeah. We alluded to this earlier, talking about like demonic possession, what was possessing David Berkowitz. Do you believe in demons?
I do.
Okay.
It's one of those subjects that seems antiquated. It seems like it's horse and buggy. Like, haven't we outgrown that?
Right.
And I would challenge rational Americans that 2/3 of the world still believe in demonic possession. It doesn't mean that there's not psychological factors. It doesn't mean that you yourself don't play a role and you're not responsible. David is responsible. He decided to let this in, so to speak. But I want you to think about times in your life when you blow it somehow. Maybe you lose your temper. I mean, we've all had those moments. You know, whatever you do, you punch a wall, you kick a cat, whatever it is you do. And when you're all done doing what you do, here's the language you use when you apologize to whoever. I'm sorry. I don't know what got into me. What got into you? I don't know what possessed me to do that. What possessed you? I got carried away. You know, our language insinuates some paranormal reality, some paranormal energy that can sometimes take us further than we ever planned on going. And that almost flies in the face of our character. It's like, I never thought I was capable of that. So I would argue that, yeah, there's a lot of psychological factors behind his crimes. I elaborate on them in the book, but there's also an interplay with a diabolical energy. And David Berkowitz is not the first serial killer to speak of this. Ted Bundy sat with the FBI for 150 hours, and he said that the crimes that he committed, it was like an out-of-the-body experience. He called it the entity, something foreign that came into him. The FBI agents, too secularists, they're not like clergymen, they said when Bundy talked about the crimes, that his baby blue eyes mutated into a pitch blackness. Dennis Rader called it the X Factor. Jeffrey Dahmer spoke of watching The Exorcist and feeling this demonic energy come over him. So Berkowitz is not the first to speak of demonic possession. He did recant the story in the 70s. You know, he was behind bars in Attica and he was being tortured by the inmates. I mean, they were barking loud from their cells, tormenting him about the demonic possession story. So to stop all the heckling, he did recant his demon possession story, but he's come back to it now in his 70s and does believe in the reality of demons, and so do I.
I mean, one point of view too would be, how convenient is it to say that, yeah, I was possessed. You know, there was demons. That's why I did these horrible things.
What makes that convenient?
It's an excuse. It's an excuse. You know,
isn't anything really, anything we say could be.
It could be, but I'm just saying that it. I mean, I'm not saying yes or no to
this. Would mental health be an excuse?
No. Oh, yeah. I mean, it could be a part of it. What I'm saying
could be considered an excuse, right?
What I'm saying is, it's just convenient for someone that's done a horrible thing and knows that they're going to prison and their only chance of parole is, you know, it's like, okay, I got to come up with something. I'm not saying this is the case, but isn't that kind of convenient?
I guess it could be.
It could be. But I'm just saying.
Yeah, in David's context, it doesn't fit what you're saying.
Okay.
Because he's not looking to get out. In fact, he blew off over half his parole hearings, and he goes on parole every 2 years. But then it was perceived as arrogance by the family of victims.
Yeah.
So he decided to show up, but he's not looking to get out. I mean, this is not a pitch to try to get out. In fact, how successful of a pitch would it be to a parole board to get out that I was possessed by the devil? I mean, it doesn't sound like a very persuasive pitch to me if I was on a parole committee. So I don't know if that logic flies. I think there's a difference between an excuse and an explanation.
Vic, you look like you have something to say.
Yeah, I had a question for Michael because he spent so much time with him. Early on, Berkowitz talked to that journalist, Maury Terry. Was he pulling his chain as far as going on with the Carr brothers being involved in this cult, and there were more people involved, or has he recanted that? Because early on, he said that I can't talk about it because it hurt my family. It's like, well, his family is long gone. I'm just kind of curious. Is he still going with that, or is there something to that, or you're able to get out of him about that?
That's probably one of the most interesting chapters of the book, because after spending a lot of time with David Berkowitz, he opened up to me about the fact that he lied to Maury Terry and he did commit these killings alone. Now, there was a cult. I mean, it's pretty established. Yonkers, Untermeyer Park, the history of cults. There was a cult. And like, true to his background, he did join the cult because he always wanted to be a part of groups. But he was on the fringes of the group. I mean, their language of, you know, wanting to create chaos in the city as cults do, definitely played a role in influencing his psychology. But the killings were maverick behavior. He was out on his own doing it, maybe partly to impress that group of people. But they, you know, they were there sort of in the background of his psyche, but they were not part of the shootings themselves. And he admits, I don't say this on every podcast, but the book has been selling more and more.
Right.
I've said in other podcasts, I'm not going to say, but at this point it's gotten so viral. Yeah,
cat's out of the bag.
Yeah. Cat's out of the bag. In fact, we met with Carl DeNaro, good guy, Carl, but Carl is of the belief that David didn't shoot him. And, you know, David and I met with Carl, and David looked at Carl in the face and said, "Carl, I'm sorry, I lied." He said, "You know, I shot you." And Carl doesn't believe it. And Carl has the right to his opinion. Good guy. Totally support Carl. And we're friends. But we agree to disagree in this particular area. Carl has wrote a book on his theory on why he believes it was the involvement of a cult. You know, that was part of the friendship with David and I. It took some time. Here's a man who had a secret. And he'd been, you know, and he had just become a Christian when he met with Maury Terry. He was young in his faith, you know, and he felt pressure. There was a lot of pressure going on there in the relationship. It's pretty complex. But he lied. And I mean, you could say, well, he lied. You can't believe him ever again. But you know what? Apply that same standard to yourself. Because surveys show that about 70% of the people in America can't go 15 minutes without telling a lie. So, you know, lying, that's true. Lying is more second nature than we realize. You know, we want to, David's easy to pick on. He's really easy to pick on. And no doubt he has lied and he has had a problem with that. And I confront him in the book about this. But when it's his opportunity to tell the truth and admit the lie, maybe he didn't do the right thing, but at least he did the right thing after he did the wrong thing. And there's some integrity in that. There's a chapter where he comes out and I call it Shocking Confessions, and he admits he did it alone.
Let me ask you two more questions. So one is, were the Carr brothers involved in that cult? And the second question is, now he did it for the attention or something. Why did he plea out? Like, why didn't he drag this through a 3-year trial of doctors and medical experts? Because it seemed like when he pled guilty and he was carrying on taunting the Moskowitz family.
Right.
And even when the perp walk, when you seen him, it looked like he was having the time of his life with this. I was always curious, why did he plea out within a year? I mean, he was in upstate New York prison within a year where he could have just dragged it. Like most guys that know they're never going to get out, they're treated better in a city facility as opposed to going upstate. I was just always curious about that, why he just pled out.
Well, if you're going with the perspective that David was having a lot of fun with this, then your question makes sense. But if you're going with the reality of what was happening with David in his head, then you can understand why he pled out. He was not having the time of his life. Yeah, he did smirk on the perp walk. What was behind that smirk? I wouldn't doubt there's some cockiness there, but it was really to cover up lots of shame. Cockiness is often a cover up for shame. There was lots of shame, lots of nervousness. People get nervous. They laugh. They smile. The police had told him he could get shot on this perp walk. Something could happen. Stay close to me. Lots of nervousness. It was also tinged with some relief. He said, "I felt relieved." But make no mistake about it, he wasn't going back to his cell gleefully. Like it was all this euphoric time of bliss. That's just Hollywood movies, and that's not reality to human nature. He didn't want to go through the trial because of the torture and the pain. He had already felt so much of it, so much shame, putting the families through this. And then he was also told by his lawyers, if you plead out, and understand he's young, he's naive, you know, you get the chance of parole someday. So he's under the influence of the lawyers. He was also meeting with the minister at the time, a woman by the name of Ali. She was out of Staten Island, I believe. And she was telling him about the gospel of Jesus Christ. And he started to feel guilt for what he did and decided, you know what? I'm the man. I own it. And just figured it in his mind, it just seemed to be the easier way to plead out. It didn't seem genuine to go down the road of not guilty by reason of insanity, and decided to plead guilty.
Yeah, that was my next question, is why wouldn't he go for, you know, the insanity defense?
You know, yeah, for all the reasons I just stated.
Yeah, I mean,
he knew it would be a long trial. He knew it would put
right.
his family yeah. through a lot of shame. It would put the victims' families through more pain. It would traumatize himself. And he was told by lawyers, look, cooperate. It's
yeah,
easier.
Because like we'd say Jeffrey Dahmer, I'm from Milwaukee. So, you know, that's what before Happy Days, you know, this is after Happy Days, you know, now we're known for Jeffrey Dahmer before we were known for Happy Days. And
Laverne and drinking, Shirley, too, right?
Laverne and Shirley. Yeah, Laverne and Shirley. Oh, yeah, you betcha. And then Jeffrey Dahmer came in and kind of ruined the whole thing. And he went to trial, not saying that I didn't do these crimes. The entire trial was, I didn't know right from wrong. I was insane at the time of these crimes. That's what the whole trial was for.
Who's this?
Jeffrey Dahmer.
Oh, okay, because David went to trial. But yeah,
No, Jeffrey Dahmer. You know, that's what it, you know, reminds me. And it's like, then I thought to myself, why wouldn't David Berkowitz do the same thing that Jeffrey Dahmer did? You know, it would make more sense. But I tell you what, the Jeffrey Dahmer trial had so many far-ranging ripple effects. I mean, like, one of the DAs wound up being a Jesuit priest. He quit being a DA. It was so disturbing to him that he wound up going to the priesthood. You know, I have a bunch of other stories that it just, you have all these hardened detectives and cops that we've seen everything. You know, it's not that, but that trial, that series of crimes was so disturbing that a human being could do that to another human being.
You know, we live in a humanistic society, meaning we are under the delusion that mankind is wonderful, that we're just good people. And when these things happen, it's just, we have delusions of goodness. We think, I could never do that. And one of the challenges of my book, I call it Monster Mirror, because this monster is a mirror, is that there's a potentiality for evil in everyone. We tend to think that these killers are other people, but there are no other people. There's only human nature. It's not like there's a separate breed or species. And I think if you study history and you go back, guys like Dr. Jordan Peterson, who I just met last week and went to his lecture and took a picture with him and put a book in his hands. He's a major voice right now in our culture. And I think he's shaking up the humanistic society to say, look back at history, 1940 Germany. If you were a citizen in Germany, I know you like to read history and empathize with the heroes, but the chances are you'd be on the wrong side of history and you'd find yourself doing things that you'd never thought you were capable of doing. So, you know, there's a potentiality for evil inside all of us. And given the right circumstances and the right series of choices, not all at once, not suddenly, but subtly, we evolve sometimes into things that we never thought we would ever evolve into.
Do you believe in criminal profiling?
Yeah, to an extent. You know.
Okay. Where does David fall into a profile?
I think in the 1970s, I think that he was definitely an antisocial personality. He definitely had antisocial personality disorder, which is known in the culture as psychopath. Psychopath is not a clinical term. It's not listed in the DSM as one of the 250 some odd psychological disorders. But it correlates with antisocial personality disorder. Not exact, but it's as close as it gets. Antisocial personality disorder, low empathy, manipulative, exploit people and their weaknesses, not a very low ability to, you know, own what you do. I mean, he had that antisocial personality disorder with psychotic breaks. The fact that he had these psychotic breaks, you know, it confused, I think, the psychiatrist at the time. One of them, I think his name was Schwartz, Dr. Schwartz, diagnosed him with schizophrenia. I don't believe David Berkowitz was a schizophrenic committing these crimes as a schizophrenic. I believe he was too calculating to be a schizophrenic. But the fact that he had intermittent psychotic breaks, it could confuse even the best of medical professionals into believing at that time that he was a schizophrenic. So I would say, at that time, an antisocial personality disorder with psychotic breaks.
Interesting. Yeah. I interviewed Catherine Ramsland, and she studied the BTK killer. Catherine Ramsland?
Okay. Yes. Yes.
I interviewed her. Very interesting. And, you know, we're talking about criminal profiling, and she said, the more we're learning about, you know, or the more we think we're learning about this, the less we really know. You know, we can't pigeonhole people. You know, it's like, oh, that's going to be a serial killer because of, you know, X, Y, and Z. It just, we can't think that way anymore.
Well, that's why I say, I think we have to come back to the ancient, timeless presupposition that has been debunked in the last 100 years under humanism, that mankind in general is capable of anything and everything. We used to think the serial killer was a certain type. Right. There was a time when criminal profilers in the late 1800s thought it was physical, and you could tell by the size of a person's cranium if they were violent. And then we evolved and said, no, it's more personality, but look out for the introverts. And then Ted Bundy emerges, and he's this charismatic, gregarious type.
Yep.
And we're like, whoa, wait a minute. We got to expand the profile a little bit.
Yeah.
But we keep expanding and expanding. We got to come back to the ancient, timeless premise of the Bible, and not just the Bible, but many manuscripts that say, listen, it's in all of us. And providing the right circumstances, a sweet little Catholic nun will hit you in the head with a tire iron.
I got the marks to prove it.
Yeah, so do I. Vic and I both went to Catholic school, so we know all about how. But hey, also, I've met some nuns that were pretty much angels. You know, I know there's the stereotype, but
I'm just being
me too. You know, it's like, it's fun to, you know, poke fun, you know, at nuns. But sure. I tell you what, some of them were absolute angels working in hospitals, you know, where I've had like life and death situations, and it would take this like little 5 foot nothing nun to make stuff happen. You know, it's amazing the power that they would wield. You know, it just, and they were, most of them are good. I'll go there. But, you know, he was, you know, we talked before that, you know, he was a serial arsonist. Do you think that had anything to do with this, or was that like a big red flag? Because he was setting, you know, he was setting fire to his stuff in the house, but then wasn't he and like his like little crew setting fire to like buildings?
Yeah, he set 1,400 fires in his life. In fact, the 1,400 fires were documented in a journal.
1,400?
Yeah, approximate. When the FBI arrested him, they went in, not the FBI, the NYPD arrested him. They went into his apartment in Yonkers, and they found the diary, and it had locations. It had the times of day, and they were able to authenticate that these fires were real. And David was actually the Phantom of the Bronx. He was a serial arsonist who was lighting fires and calling the police or the fire department, the authorities, after the fire to tell them, you know, just lit this building on fire, this vacant lot, this abandoned car. So the Son of Sam and the Phantom of the Bronx, both names in the 70s that were making headlines in the newspaper, were the same person. Wow.
You know what? And that I believe it, because the Bronx at the time was a target-rich environment, because you had tons of abandoned buildings in the Bronx. I remember as a rookie cop, 10 years after the Son of Sam in 1987, I'm talking streets that went on for blocks of just six-story walk-ups that were abandoned, and abandoned cars all over the place too in these lots, or sometimes they would drive a stolen car in the back of a building. So yeah, it was a target-rich environment. It would be nothing for him to set something on fire back then.
Yeah, and how that relates to the killings, I mean, it's the same root, different fruit. It's this rage inside, and he gets a dopamine rush from lighting the fires, same dopamine rush he's getting from pulling the trigger, and it becomes addictive. Violence can be addictive. I mean, we've got a lot of studies in the literature to back that up. It becomes something addictive. He's classically conditioned that, you know, by lighting this fire or pulling the trigger, it gives me this sense of relief, and he keeps coming back to it. The FBI know that in interviewing arsonists, that there are really usually two motivations. One is sexual, which is not the case with David. You know, there's an orgasm or some kind of sexual release at the lighting of the fire. We'll call it lustful. And the other arsonists are livid. They're angry, and it's an outlet for their rage. And David was the livid type, not the lustful type. And it definitely, it's similar to the mindset behind the shootings.
We'll be right back.
Today's episode is sponsored by the thrilling audiobook, Avenging Adam, book one in the FBI K-9 thriller series written by author Jody Burnett. Sparks fly between hotshot FBI agent Rick Sanchez and no-nonsense FBI canine handler Kendra Dean as they chase a ruthless serial killer. Witness an electrifying blend of suspense, romance, and redemption, where internal conflicts challenge our heroes as much as their target does. Will they catch the killer before it's too late? Grab Avenging Adam now. It's more than a story. It's an experience. Get 50% off the Avenging Adam audiobook at jody-burnett.com/copsandwriters.
You know, we're talking about, you know, society, et cetera. You know, I am on the cusp of Gen X and baby boomer. You know, depending on what you look at, I'm Gen X or I'm a baby boomer.
I'm a Gen X.
Yeah. I'm right there. I never could skateboard very well, but I do like flannel. So my heart's with Gen X. But, you know, a lot of us were latchkey kids, you know, compared to right now, there's helicopter parents, and I call them snowplow parents, where they take every obstacle out of the way of their children. But it seems like kids are even more troubled now. There's more violence. There's more kids, you know, with anxiety, depression. And I don't know what the percentages are of kids on psychotropic drugs. That it just seems like it's getting worse and worse the more we try to control or help them.
Well, we know from the data that avoidant behaviors increases anxiety. It doesn't decrease it. And parents, helicopter parents, are really good at insulating their kids from any type of pressure, any type of trigger. And the more you insulate the kid from the triggers and the pressure, very much like your immune system, if you're never exposed to germs,
that makes sense.
You're going to have a very fragile immune system. Same thing with the psyche. If you're constantly avoiding pressure, you're just going to become very fragile and be lacking in resilience. Reminds me of a story I often tell in my psychology classes, where a little boy sees a caterpillar trying to push its way through a chrysalis, and he wants to help the caterpillar out because he sees him struggling, and he cuts open the chrysalis with the razor blade, and the caterpillar rolls over on his back and it dies. And an entomologist says you should have never did that, because through the struggle, the caterpillar builds his wings to become a butterfly. You just clipped his wings. Uh-huh. And moms and dads are clipping wings of their kids everywhere, by insulating them, becoming very fragile and not able to deal with reality on reality's terms.
I think we're built for adversity and we need it.
Yeah.
And I think the big difference between the way the three of us grew up, there wasn't electronics for a developing mind. And my parents would tell me, go outside and play and don't come back until the streetlights come on.
Yeah, absolutely. And
we were building forts, just throwing fireworks at each other or playing games. We're getting into trouble. And I got in trouble quite a bit as a kid, and then the police department saved me. But, you know, it's I think these kids nowadays, they spend too much time with phones and tabs. And I don't think that they're getting life skills and education.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I was visiting my mother-in-law with my wife a couple of days ago. And I was telling her about my childhood. You know, it's like my buddy that lived behind us, his dad gave him a pair of boxing gloves. So his dad set up like a boxing ring in the backyard, and we'd just go back and just beat the shit out of each other. You know, and just, I thought it was the coolest thing ever. Yeah, I mean, as a kid, oh, it was awesome. You know, we would do that kind of stuff all the time. Yeah, and it just... Today, I mean, well, first of all, you'd be scared to death. You're going to get sued. You know, if little Johnny, you know, your kid goes in there and, you know, gives the neighbor kid a good shiner or something like that, of course, they're going to be rushing to the emergency room. Of course, they're going to say, you know, X, Y, and Z is wrong with them. And, you know, then you're going to be hearing from their attorney. You know, it just is a different world. You know, when you get into a fight or a disagreement, it's like, what would you do at the end? You'd shake hands. You know, the adult or parent would be like, shake hands. You know, it's like, okay, I'm sorry. Didn't mean to do that. You know, that kind of thing. So
you take everything we're saying and, you know, a little rejection, break up with the girlfriend, whatever. I can't handle it. No surprise, 13 mass shootings a week in the United States. That kind of fragile temperament, having to handle reality. And not knowing how to cope with reality, it's going to cause a reaction, a backlash.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. It's I don't like the way it's going, but it is going. So when you were meeting with David, At any point, did you ever think that he was playing you, that he's just like this master manipulator? Because he's very intelligent.
I mean, of course, you know, being a PhD in behavioral science and being trained in human behavior, I'm paying attention.
Yeah.
I'm not cynical. I don't think that the cynic is wise. I think a cynic is looking for, you know, they're looking for a problem when sometimes there is no problem. So I'm skeptical, but not cynical.
Okay.
I'm going to question things. I got a chance to see not only David's actions. People think actions are a good test of a litmus test of character, but people can put on an act very well. I mean, Shakespeare said the world is a stage. We're all acting to some degree. But what's hard to fake is reactions. So I got a chance to see not just David's actions. I got a chance to see his reactions. Actions in real time. Actions when he's caught off guard, when things don't go his way, when stuff is unplanned, you know, taken by surprise. I showed up at one session and he had a conflict with an inmate and he was very angry. The inmate said something very degrading. I tell about it in the second chapter of my book. I won't get into too many of the details, but I got a chance to see David navigate through anger. And that was a real good session for me because I got a chance to see how he would handle anger. Now, you could say, well, he's behind bars, and of course he's not going to do what he did in Free Society. Listen, the first 10 years of him being behind bars, he's put in the hole for 60 days because he almost kills an inmate. So he got slashed in the neck. So he had his outbursts, but even behind bars. And I watched him like a pro navigate through that anger. And rather than externalizing, which people do when they're angry, it's always outside. It's people, places, things. He internalizes and he self-reflects. And we talk about what's really behind the anger, because anger is typically a cover-up emotion. It's a secondary response of the brain to masquerade more vulnerable feelings like fear or hurt or shame. And we got a chance to go down a road of introspection. And I walked away from that session saying, this guy has grown tremendously. So I've seen his reactions, not just his actions. And I'm a believer that though I think he should stay behind bars, I'm not arguing for his release, and neither is he. I do think he has experienced some real change and transformation and has worked tremendously on his character in the last 35 years.
Yeah. You know, going back a little bit, you know, he worked at the post office during this crime spree. You know, did he ever allude to you that, you know, he was going to go postal and do like a mass shooting at the post office? I know that's very, you know, stereotypical. And I know that also from reading the book that he was very close to going into, was it a nightclub or somewhere where he was just going to shoot it up.
Yeah, he actually visited the Hamptons, about an hour and a half drive from Yonkers, a couple of days before he was arrested. And he was ready to do, he was ready to go on a shootout at the Hamptons. I mean, he had his artillery with him, and it rained. It was an outdoor, it was a disco club in the summer. And that rain was really a gift from heaven, because people were going to get hurt that night. He went back to his apartment in Yonkers, and then the day he was arrested, he says he was on his way to commit a shootout. He was going to go right back to the Hamptons and die in a blaze of fire, because Son of Sam wasn't just homicidal, it was also suicidal. He was self-destructing. He was trying to destroy himself as well as humanity. You know, the saying, misery loves company. Well, in this case, misery demands hostages. Misery takes prisoners.
Sure.
And he was on his way to commit a shootout. And thank God the Yonkers police caught him, you know, in time. The NYPD caught him in time right before he went on that shootout.
Yeah. You know, did he ever say that he had any animosity towards his like postal employees or bosses or anything like that?
Nothing. No, it was a stressful job. He actually built some relationships.
Okay.
In the post office. But like all of his relationships, you know, there's a difference between being with people and bonding with people. And David never knew really how to bond well. He always had this secret interior that he kind of kept to himself and kept them, you know, your secrets will separate you from people, even when you're with them and they're in their company. He would walk ladies to their cars at night. They were scared because the Son of Sam was at loose.
Wow.
And in his mind, he wasn't playing a game.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, he's really, he was wrestling. There was a lot of conflict going on in his mind. And maybe in some respect, he's trying to do a good deed to wash away his bad deeds. I mean, while he's hunting for victims in the streets of New York, he has in his trunk an emergency kit in case he sees someone stuck, he can help them. On one particular night in January 1977, while he's hunting for a victim, a couple of ladies are stuck in a snowbank. And he, sure enough, he stops. He helps, you know, gets his flashlight out, helps pull the car out of the snowbank, wishes them well, gets in his car and goes looking for a victim.
Wow. That's, wow. That's something else. So do you know if any of his victims or relatives of victims ever attend parole hearings, and does he interact with them at these parole hearings?
No, there's no presence of families of victims at the parole hearings.
There is not. So they can't give like a victim impact statement or anything like that.
Not now. I don't think there was early on, but see, even early on, the parole hearings didn't begin till the '90s. I think the involvement of family kind of dwindled. I don't, I'm 99% sure that I don't think there was ever a parole hearing in the 10 parole hearings.
Okay.
That the presence of family and families of victims, from what David has told me.
All right. Now, I know we kind of touched on this a little bit. Do you see any similarities between David and more like recent serial killers?
Not as much with serial killers as with mass shooters.
Okay.
You know, if think of David's killings as, you know, similar to a mass shooting, like a school shooting,
but
just
spread out. Okay.
Just spread out over time.
Interesting. Okay.
He would hit and run.
Hit and run.
Yeah. Now, you, I think you were stating that one of the victim's mothers was in contact with him. Were there any other, you know, instances where victims or victims, you know, relatives have reached out to him?
Carl DeNaro, who David shot in the head, and Nisa Moskowitz, from what I know, were the only two people connected to the murders that David was in contact with. Nisa, she forgave him, which was absolute miracle from God, because Nisa hated him.
Yeah.
Rightfully so. I mean, she was on all kinds of talk shows, just calling him every name in the book. And, you know, she lost her daughter. And they got so close, him and Nisa. I say Nisa, it's actually Nisa. They got so close. I've got letters behind me where she's writing him saying, "Dave, please pray for my other daughter who's sick." She was sick with something. She ended up dying. Mm. But please pray for her. Here is Nisa asking David, the guy that killed Stacy, to pray for her, Stacy's sister. So Nisa really had... She said that, in her own words, she was eaten away with bitterness and anger, and forgiveness was the only way out of her cell. And that's really what forgiveness is. I mean, it is setting a prisoner free and finding out the prisoner is you. So Nisa forgave, and it set herself free, and she began a relationship with him. They were just about to meet, and Maury Terry kind of was involved with that and wanted to make it a televised special, and David didn't want it to be televised. It kind of soured things, and then Nisa was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. Yeah. And she died. So the only contact they had was through letter writing and through phone calls.
Wow. All right. Now, Michael, before this project, did you have the thought of meeting with any of the victims or the families of the victims before you interacted with David?
No, Carl DeNaro, one day I just noticed that he was following me on social media. Mm. Someone must have told him that I was doing this particular project, and I reached out to him. I initiated the contact. Okay. after I saw he followed me. I thought, wow, that's interesting. Carl DeNaro's following me. I mean, I was putting on social media because, understand, I'm writing a book.
Right.
I'm going to publish it. I've got to build up a following, right?
Sure.
So I'm on social media talking about, and plus my social media page already over the last 15 years has been all about mental health. So it just ties right into who I am and my mission. And Carl hears through the grapevine about me and what I'm doing, follows me. I sent him a message, said, "Carl, I'm flattered that you're following me. Love to go to dinner with you. We meet for dinner in Queens, get to know each other. Great guy. Very gentle, humble, wise. I mean, nothing good but good to say about him. And then at some point, David says, I want to meet with him. Okay. I want to meet with Carl, and I want to just tell him what happened.
Okay.
And that's when we met.
Now, I have a Cops and Writers Facebook group, and I put out that, you know, we were going to be speaking. You know, there's a couple of questions from there. So Mike Tuggle, it's more of a statement. He says, I'm reminded of Nietzsche's warning about staring into the abyss. And Miriam Hasham, I'm guessing I'm probably butchering her last name. I hope not. I've always been curious about how serial killers in prison interact with other prisoners. How do they get on with the general prison population, or are they in a separate part of the prison?
No, he's in the general public.
Okay.
He's in the general population. He's not in isolation. He's not, you know, sequestered in any way, like maybe a Mark David Chapman I know is still, he's still isolated from the rest of the population. David is part of general population. He has the respect of lots of the inmates. They actually call him Pastor Dave.
Hmm.
He has a lot of the young men that are looking for faith turn to him. David has Bible studies with these young men once a week. And he's pretty fatherly, if you want to look for an adjective, to some of these inmates.
Okay. Do they find
him? Sorry.
No, go ahead.
He's been there so long, and then guys go upstate and they're like, oh, wow. It's almost for them meeting a celebrity in jail, believe it or not.
Yeah, I could see that.
Believe it or not, the young people don't. I asked him that question before.
Yeah.
He said, Mike, he said, believe it or not, a lot of the young people don't even know.
No, but I mean like 20 years ago.
Oh, sure.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Definitely. Absolutely. You know, he definitely had his fans, so to speak.
Then she asked, do they find camaraderie with other serial or mass killers, because they have shared experience, or do they avoid each other?
No, David is not of that ilk. I'm sure some are, but okay. Not David. I mean, I dealt with two other ones that were definitely psychopathic through and through, and even used religion in their speech to me. But, you know, after being with them enough times, I was able to kind of see through it. So, you know, for those that say, well, how do you know David's not manipulating you? This is not my first rodeo. You know, I'm trained in this area. I've sat with him long enough. I've already ruled out two others. So I tell you, if I thought he was a fraud.
Yeah.
Okay. I think he's perfect. He's not perfect.
Yeah.
But any blemish, you know, you find in his character, he's pretty transparent about it.
Okay.
And that's more than I can say for most people in free society. So, you know, he's an imperfect man. Sure he is.
Yeah.
But I'd say he's pretty legitimate in his faith, in the practice of his faith.
Interesting. Now, does the structure of prison life bring them a kind of peace or settling down that maybe they could never find in the real world, out in the freedom?
Excellent question. Very insightful.
Yes.
And yes. Yeah. I mean, there's a structure and a routine that I think has been very useful in him finding solace and being restored to sanity. You know, apart from that structure and routine, I don't know. I mean, that routine has been really good for him. David always did well with structure and routine. Even in elementary school, when he had a vice principal really take a liking to him in third, fourth grade, when he was a real rascal in class, and teachers would put his desk in the middle of the class and say, this is where the bad boys sit. Because, you know, back then, the 50s, the Bronx. But he had a vice principal that took a liking to him. She was there for a brief period of time, and she really put some structure to him and made him a whole monitor. And he started to really flourish in the structure. But outside structure and routine, I don't know what would become of him. I know it's been good for him.
Okay, great. All right, and she also thanks us for all of this. So let's start wrapping this up. What's next for you, Michael?
Well, I teach at two colleges. I do that Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, psychology courses. One of the colleges is a Christian college. The other one is a secular. And then on weekends, pretty much every weekend this year, with the exception of three, I speak in churches, rehabs, schools, prisons on mental health subjects. I'm pretty booked up there. I usually bring my books with me at these speaking venues. It's been one of the ways that I sell books and get the word out there and David's story out there. That keeps me busy. I don't really know what the next project is yet.
Okay.
I've got the book in the hands of some pretty influential people in culture. We'll see where it takes me. I score high on openness when it comes to personality traits. So I'm open. I also have another inmate that's reading the book. I don't want to say his name just yet, but if I said his name, most people would know. Possibility of me doing the same thing with that person. I mean, I wouldn't sit down and do this again unless the person was candid, sincere in their desire to see change. I'm not looking to tell, I'm not some serial killer fanboy looking to tell, you know, some glorious story about crimes, glorifying crimes. That's not right. Why anybody that knows me knows that that's not my deal. But if it was somebody that was wanting to make a difference and help those that are at the cusp of destruction in our culture, I mean, just in absolute darkness in their heads, then I could partner with that person.
Okay. Now, Vic, do you have anything final for us? Any stories or anything regarding us, David?
Just a couple of quick ones. Early in my career, I had a narcotic seizure. In the old days, the NYPD's lab was on the top, one of the top floors of the police academy. So you'd get off the elevator. To your left was the lab. To the right was ballistics. So I drop it off with a supervisor, and we come back into the hallway, and we're waiting for the elevator. And there's a display case on the wall, and it looked like something you would make in a shop class. It wasn't professionally done, but it was behind glass. And I'm looking, and there's a Thompson machine gun, and there's a couple of little Derringers there. And then staring right in front of me is David Berkowitz's Charter Arms Bulldog mounted on the wall. And I'm saying to myself, what? No one would know this is here. You know, it's right. Like, it's just like, just to see something that bizarre just sitting there, they had it mounted behind glass. And then to the right of it was the gun that killed John Lennon. So yeah, the NYPD, I don't know what happened to these things now, because they had since moved the lab out to Queens. It might be out there, but it was just one of those things that you see. Another time, I had to pick up someone's rap sheets. Nowadays, you can just log online and pull a III up. But back then, you had to go to one police plaza, and then these walls of computers that looked like something in a 1970s movie with the reels turning. And it was hot as hell in there. And I remember waiting to get some rap sheets, and they had his fingerprint card.
No kidding.
Mounted on the wall up there. And I'm just kind of staring at it. And, you know, he signed it. You know, and I'm just kind of looking at it. Like, you sign the old fingerprint, the ink card, you'd make him sign it. But I just, it was just some of those things you would just get to see. And then I guess the final story about him, my friend, another detective, purchased a condo in his building years after, 10, 15 years after. And I think it was 35 Pine Street, but then you had all these ghouls coming and taking photos and stealing stuff out of the lobby.
Okay.
The condo association successfully lobbied the city of Yonkers to change the address to 42 Pine Street. But that would confuse the mailman. And my friend's mail, he often had to go across the street to get it. And when I was a teenager, so you're talking, when did I join the NYPD? 87. So 84, 85, right out of high school, we thought we were going to be badasses. And we would go up to Untermyer Park and look around, and I could definitely see they had like little underground caves there and stuff. And I could definitely see where you could see a bunch of teenage boys up to no good starting fires and stuff down there. But that's my take of rubbing elbows with David Berkowitz.
Okay. So, Michael, if somebody wants to learn more about you and your books and your work, where do they go?
I'm a very active presence on Facebook. You can look up Mike Caparelli. You'll get daily, probably a few times a day, teachings on mental health, promotions of wherever I'm at, what I'm doing. You can go on Amazon to buy the book, Monster Mirror, 100 Hours with David Berkowitz. You can get it in paperback. You can get it in Spanish. You can get it the Kindle version. You can go on Barnes & Noble. They have it there on their website. And then my own website is called Unmuted, UNMUTED, the name of the nonprofit that I founded, unmuted.app, APP, and you'll get a little bit of insight on my nonprofit that is a relating to mental health from a faith-based perspective. And yeah, so Facebook, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and the website.
Now this unmuted.app, are there links for the book and anything else?
Yeah, there's a store on the website where all five books that I've written.
I will throw that in the show notes so people can go to that. Vic, if they want to find out about you and all of your books, where do they go?
Just go to Amazon, type in my name, Vic Ferrari Like the Car, where you can preview all my behind-the-scenes NYPD books for free and check out my podcast, NYPD Through the Looking Glass.
All right. I think we will exit here. Michael, thank you so much for being on the show today. And Vic, of course, thank you for being on the show again. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Patrick. This was really a lot of fun. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Most definitely. Lots of fun in getting to know you guys. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to the conclusion of my interview with bestselling author and psychologist, Dr. Michael Caparelli. And thank you, Vic Ferrari, for taking the time to be with us today. This has been a fascinating and thought-provoking conversation. Well, that wraps up another episode of the Cops and Writers Podcast. If you haven't done so yet, could you take a minute and rate and review the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts? If you have already, thank you. As always, thank you for all of your support, and, of course, let's be careful out there.